Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. Clavis Natera was born in the Dominican Republic, migrated to the United States at 10 years old, and grew up in New York City. Her exhilarating debut novel, Neruda on the Park, follows members of a Dominican family in New York City who take radically different paths when faced with encroaching gentrification. The book is a beautifully layered portrayal of family, friendship, and ambition. Now let's join the author in conversation with her editor, Chelsea Johns.
Clavis, I'm so, so happy to be speaking with you today. You know this novel is near and dear to my heart. It was the first project I acquired as a senior editor here at Ballantyne and fell in love with one of the characters even before I saw the full novel. From a short story of yours, how are you feeling coming full circle a month out from publication?
I feel wonderful. It is so, so great to be here with you and to have this conversation. A month before the book comes out into the world feels to me like such a wonderful, serendipitous moment just to pause and think about this long journey. I'm so happy to be here.
Yes, I'm so happy to be speaking with you. So I'm going to dive right in. So Neruda on the Park follows a Dominican family in contemporary New York who take radically different paths when faced with encroaching gentrification. I mean, the mother, Eusebia, starts a fake crime ring to scare newcomers away, lose. The daughter actually ends up kind of somewhat falling for. The developer, the mother, vehemently opposes, all the while the father, Vladimir, is building a home for his family secretly behind the mother's back. It's really a story about community, about family, a mother-daughter story. But what inspired this novel? I know you wrote it over a large span of time. How did you know this was the one to stick with?
Yeah, I mean, I love that question. There were so many points of inspiration for me. First of all, Neruda on the Park is very much rooted in my experiences as an immigrant growing up in New York City. It's also a celebration of my community, my Dominican community, both here and back in the Dominican Republic. That spirit of hard work and fun and, you know, just a lot of those experiences, I think, were very important for me to inject into the book. But I would say that beyond a celebration of my own community, and a point of inspiration for me was also thinking broadly about, you know, what I was going through personally over the 15 years of my life where I was writing this book. And, you know, when I think about some of the bigger themes of this book, relationships, yes, love, yes, but also mental health, you know, it was a really big departure point for me to think about mental health in the women in my family, and also to think about work, which is a huge part of what Luz is going through in this book, and to think about, you know, myself. I was working a corporate job the entire time I was writing this book. And for me, there's a big question that I had as I was writing this book about the promises that corporate America makes and fails to deliver on. So for me, that was also like a really big point. So inspiration was my life, and I think a celebration of my life and also some deep excavation of themes that are important to me.
Yeah, so like themes was a question I had a few down, but you just jumped right in. And so now I'm just going to follow up on that. You talked about the mental health, and one of the themes that I certainly walked away with was this inherited trauma that sometimes we have in our families passed on from woman to woman that we don't even talk about. That's kind of buried within. You know, I think you do such a good job. Is it Naima Coster's quote too? Just like it's thrilling but smart, like it has all of the above, where it's the heart and it's the terror and this tenderness of relationships, but it's still really sexy and fun too. How did you manage to pull that off, to go deep and yet still keep some levity?
You know, I think for me it was really important that this idea of inherited trauma, which is something I've experienced in my own family, I mean, there's been a lot of anxiety and depression, and there has been a lot of loss that has happened through my family, not just the women, but everyone. And when I thought about what I wanted to happen in this book is for Eusebia and the inherited trauma or the silences that have existed in her own life, I wanted that to become transformed into a force, mm-hmm. so that in the book itself, it would be like she's fighting against gentrification, but it's actually fighting against a silence that she has never been able to utter. And so when I thought about, you know, how do I tell a book that's really difficult, that's dealing with really difficult things, but in honoring my own oral storytelling legacy, that to me means that you have to make it really sexy and really addictive. And so for me, part of the goal in doing that was to really bring the story of Luz, you know, to the forefront, and to show that even though Luz also has some really serious concerns, her approach to life is just sensuous, and it's really like seeking purpose through pleasure and through meaning. And so to me, there was just like a perfect balance between these two characters.
When you first started writing the novel, what character came first? What was your writing process like?
Oh, well, that's funny because, you know, I'll say that Eusebia is the heart of the book, but the story for me always, the entry point was always Luz. You know, when I first came back from college, I went away to college in upstate New York to Skidmore College. And I remember coming back and looking around in my neighborhood and noticing that in the same ways that I had been transformed by leaving my community and then coming back, my community had been transformed. There had been a great deal of change that was happening at that time in Harlem that is very evident now. I mean, we're talking now about, you know, 20 years ago. And for me, like coming back and feeling a lot of the disconnectedness that I felt being part of a community where like I loved my community, but I felt outside of it, mm-hmm. I was really interested in exploring that. And for me, Luz was just a very easy entry point. What's interesting about the story, though, is that I kept resisting letting Eusebia have her own point of view because I felt like her story was there's just so much rage and anger that this woman felt. And I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to give it, to do it justice. And so I'm just really glad that I eventually let Eusebia have her own point of view.
And you definitely do it justice. I have to say for your listeners that, I mean, it's so hard to put down. You know that there's this, something is happening, and I will not do any spoilers, but something is happening with Eusebia, and you have to keep reading to figure out, like, what's real, what's not, what pushes her the way she moves. One of my questions was actually about Eusebia. And, you know, in our edit, that she was one of the characters that I was like, I want to know more of her. I want to pull her out more before we see her in her rage. And what was her relationship like with Luz? What was that process like for you to go back and revisit her during the edit and bring even more of what I know was like drafts from previous writing back to the book?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say this is where this episode becomes a love fest because I actually don't think that if I hadn't been working with you and the ways in which you really push me to think about this story, to think very carefully about the construction of Eusebia as a character, I don't think that the book would be as beautiful, honestly, and as profound as it is. You really helped me, I think, not just to do more justice, I think, in really getting deeply into the motivation and into exactly what happened, but also, which is really interesting, slowing down the action, because part of what I wanted to happen, I wanted it to happen very fast. Like I wanted this idea of you know, for me, there's a trope that exists today around the immigrant, especially immigrant women, that is around us as very passive and subservient. And that has not been my experience. I mean, the women in my family, in my community are strong and they fight. And so for me, I just wanted it to happen so fast. And I am so grateful that you and I were able to work together because there's just like so much tenderness and so much love in Eusebia's actions. And I think through our process, that comes across so much more clearly.
Yeah, we definitely get to see more of her humanity and then Luz's humanity through their relationship. So I'm really excited about readers getting like sinking their teeth into that. You talked about like Eusebia, and you know, you wanted it to go fast. I did have a question around like You know, she makes some pretty risky, dangerous, sometimes also hilarious moves throughout trying to save her home and her community. Did anything surprise you while writing her? I've heard authors speak about, you know, characters try to take over the novel. Like, did that ever happen with any character here?
Yeah, I mean, I think both Eusebia and the Tongues. So the Tongues are these gossipy women who live in this building, and they really act both as like archives of the history of the community, as well as just being really delicious storytellers. So for me, it was really interesting because there was a version of this book where like the entire book was being told through the Tongues' point of view. As this kind of first-person plural narrative. And then it was, I was like, no, you guys have to be quiet. I know you guys are the Tongues and like your whole thing is being gossipy, but this book cannot be told through your POV. And so, yeah, I think that Eusebia was definitely one of those characters that where I, when I eventually got to the point where I realized that her having her own storyline was as critical to the narrative as Luz's transformation. For me, it was a complete pivotal point in the creation of this book.
And to talk a bit more about, like, the characters that we haven't spoken of, you know, for me, I've jokingly said this before, that I was so wrapped up in the novel on my first read that I ordered takeout, and I ordered the exact same meal the characters was having because I was just like, just want the full experience. I'm going to keep drinking coffee because Eusebia drinks coffee. And I was like, oh, this is not good for my liver. However, what I'm really saying is that what you do so well is place us so intimately into these characters' lives, into the scene that just, I wanted to 3D it for some reason, apparently. But I didn't feel that way just about Eusebia or about Luz or about Vladimir. I felt that way about Auntie and Angelica, the friend in this novel. I felt that way about, you know, the man who deals with kind of addiction off and on. Like, I felt that way about everyone. And I want to say, you know, this novel is about one family, about two women, but it's really about a community. And I wonder, you know, why was that so important for you, for the community and the quote-unquote secondary characters to feel as rich and as important to this project?
Oh, thank you. I keep being like, thank you for that question. It's so brilliant. You know, for me, I think, first of all, as a teacher, I teach creative writing. And one of the things that I often tell my students is that, you know, there shouldn't be one character in your narrative that's boring. Like, every character has desires and has a point of view and has something really important to contribute. And so for me, that was one of the things that was really critical, was to really make sure that this was a fictional world that felt full, that felt alive. And also because I, you know, some of my favorite books are books that are about community. You know, when I think about, you know, the legacies of Toni Morrison and Julia Alvarez and Tayari Jones, you know, like just these writers that mean so much to me. It is often about having characters that are making the way through the world and that those that are around them are just as alive and have just as much to contribute to those realizations that I think we as readers love to witness. Yeah. So for me, that's just really like a critical part of what I love most as a reader. So I wanted to put that in the book.
Yeah, when it comes to community, I mean, I think about so many scenes in the novel, whether it's Aunt Kuka who's coming home and helping to rally the woman in some way, wanting to reshape their body, and the conversations you get to have around women's autonomy and choice, to just the love fest that happens early on between Luz and Hudson and wondering where it's going to go. And I was really actually surprised as a editor and also was like, do I want more from them? But there are so many elements that, you know, scenes that I just loved and wanted to sit in. What's your favorite scene in this book?
Oh, you know, I feel like I can't talk about my favorite scene because it's at the very end and we don't want to spoil it. But let me say this. I think for me, water has always been one of the most soothing and comforting elements in my own life. And so, you know, when just last August, I spent the month of August in the Dominican Republic, and I hadn't been back in a really long time. It's, you know, it's my place of birth, but my home is here, is the United States. And when I went to the Dominican Republic, I had an opportunity to like live by the sea for, you know, almost a month. And taking those daily walks, I feel like, fortified me in a way that really reminded me of why water plays such an important role in this book. Mm-hmm. And so for me, there's several scenes in the book where Eusebia is by the water or in the water that just help her to come to terms with the history and the pain that she has suffered. And so for me, those were the moments when I felt most moved by the narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's, I think I reread the scene of Eusebia. I believe kind of the bed almost feels like a body of water and how she's moving through that moment of pain, but also release. You kind of have to read it to know what we're talking about. You're going to love it and fall in love. Yeah, I guess the next question here is, you did speak about the tongues and how at one point the narrative was driven by them. I actually wanted to ask, you know, how did you come to this dual narrative of for sure Eusebia and Luz need to be the main narrators? And how did you come to that and when?
Yeah, so, you know, I started writing this book, like I said, about 15 years ago. And, you know, for, I would say probably for the first 8 years of that, the story was really being told either from Luz's point of view as a first person narrative, or then I, you know, for a while I tried the tongues being this first person plural, telling the entire story. And, you know, one of the things that I realized about this narrative is that I couldn't really tell a story about a mother and a daughter without having the mother and the daughter being the ones that were telling the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the biggest change really was me becoming a mother, which happened right around the time when I gave Eusebia her own platform, you know, and I think that for me, becoming a mom just really put into stark relief the plot points of what Eusebia had been through. And so for me, that was a really important point, and I'm really grateful that I have both my children who taught me a lot about, you know, what it means to be a mother, what it means to lose, you know, parts of who you are when you become a mother. And so it became more urgent at that point to have Eusebia be part of the story and have her own voice.
Let's talk a bit about Eusebia's choices and what it means to save her home. There are some extreme moments of how she thinks, you know, best ways to go forward. And I won't say anything that's not already in the description copy, at least. And starting this fake crime ring, where did that come from? How did you come up with that idea that could be a source to, one, help maybe save her community, but also a way to construct tension and pace in the project?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that has been true about the story, regardless of the versions of it that I attempted, is this crime ring. And one of the reasons why it was really important, and it was a pivotal part of, like, this narrative from the beginning, was that Eusebia is not, she starts out in the narrative as someone who really is a caretaker, and she caretakes for everybody in her community, not just her husband and her daughter and her sister, but really everyone in her building and everyone around that park. I mean, she's the person that cooks for the community. She's the person that people come to for different needs. And so having her as someone who yielded a great deal of authority in the community was very important. And for that authority to be grounded in love was very important. So I don't know exactly when this happened, but I remember drafting the first version of this where Luz was telling the story in first person, which was very difficult, as you can imagine, because Luz isn't really supposed to know what her mother is doing, which is one of the best parts of the book, I think, because, it's, you know, there's a part of us as readers that are like, we can't wait for Luz to discover what her mother is doing. But, you know, for me, it was just, You know, first of all, it was agency. Exactly what you're saying is really about showing the ways in which love can transform people into monsters, even if that's difficult for us to admit to each other. And it was also about showing how if there is a silence in our lives, and you know, what that silence is covering often is a lot of pain. And the longer that goes unresolved, I think the bigger the reaction to addressing it. And so for me, it was just also true, even though it's so extreme and it's not anything that I've ever witnessed in my own life. But to me, it felt true to form that the situation would continue to escalate and escalate and escalate until we as readers are horrified.
You're horrified and then you're brought back to like love and tenderness. And in some ways, not everything is resolved whatsoever, which I don't think that isn't reality. But you're left empowered in love with these people and this community. And also thinking about your own community, I definitely walked away from the Ruin on the Park thinking about Detroit and my family. That said, what do you want readers to walk away feeling after having read The Ruin on the Park?
Oh, I have so many feelings about what I want readers to feel. I mean, my biggest hope is that readers will see themselves in the story. I think very often when we think about immigrant communities or when we think about writers like me who have an accent or who have been born in another country, we very often think of those people as foreigners. And one of the things that I want to challenge in this book is the idea of who is American and who belongs here and whose story it is. So even though this is, you know, a sexy story and a funny story and it's chilling in some ways, just like you said, at the end of the day, it's a story about a family. It's a story about two women who are facing a great deal of change in their lives. And I think most people will be able to see themselves in the situation. And through the extremes that both these women experience and that the broader community experience, I think there's a lot that I hope will bring readers to think deeply and talk for a long time about their own experiences and their own family, their own community. So that's what I hope readers take away.
All right, just two more questions. My second to last is really kind of a brag on you for a second. You've gotten some great reviews. I mean, the blurbs just kept pouring in from everyone you could think of. Tyree Jones, Uli Alvarez, Naima Acosta, Robert Jones Jr., Jenny Afo. Like, how did it feel for you as a debut author to have all these authors that you love and admire share words and love about your own book?
Oh, I mean, first of all, you and I took such painstaking care of who we asked for blurbs because we both felt that it was really important that, you know, the people that we asked for endorsement of the book were also people who we thought the book was in conversation with. And so for me, I was, first of all, very scared about having these people that I love so deeply read my book because I also thought if they didn't like the book, I would be heartbroken. And so, you know, there was a lot of tension, I think, and fear of putting my work out there in the world. And when the blurb started coming in, I mean, I have not cried that many happy tears in my entire life, I have to say. It was so humbling to have worked on this book for so long and to have almost walked away from this book altogether, feeling defeated so many times. And then to now, you know, be at a point where the writers that I love most in the entire world are each saying such kind things. I mean, it just made me feel really fortunate and blessed and also really lucky to be part of a community of people that are so generous.
Yeah. So staying on the thread of authors that we all love and that you love, I know you do a really wonderful job of using your Instagram platform to have conversations with debut authors and books that you're loving and reading. And so many people respect your recommendations. If you are not following Clavis on IG, you certainly should be. But, you know, what are you reading now that you're loving and you would recommend to others?
I'm a big bookworm, and I tell people that as much as I love writing, I just as much love reading. And so it brings me a lot of pleasure to be in a point in my life where I can dedicate a lot of my time to reading. So I read a lot for my work because I teach creative writing. And then I'm fortunate enough that people will send me free books. So if you're out there and you want me to read your book, send it to me. I love reading it. Right now I'm actually, I just finished reading Layla Motley's Night Crawling, which blew me away. I mean, Layla and I met through a Random House event. Thank you, Random House, for bringing me a new friend. And, you know, she and I started talking to each other through Instagram. And, we exchanged books, our galleys, the early versions of our books. And I was blown away, not just because she wrote this book when she was a teenager, you know, but also because the book is great. Yeah. And so for me, like, that is definitely a book that I would ask people to really check out and to support Layla. I just finished also an incredible thing has happened to me now, which is that Angie Cruz, who is also an incredible writer I admire, who also gave me a blurb, sent me her new book that's coming out in September, mm-hmm. How Not to Drown in a Glass of Water. And her main character, Cara Romero, is a Dominican woman who has lost her job, which connects with Luz's storyline, as you know. And her, the structure of this book is really interesting because the main character has to go through these sessions for unemployment. And so the story itself moves through the conversation she's having with this counselor. And it is just such a heartfelt, it just made me think about my mom, and it made me think about so many women that I know who sometimes find themselves unexpectedly with a lot more weight that they can bear, and how those experiences sometimes help people to become like a better version of themselves. So I love that. And can I do one more?
Sure.
So the last one I will recommend is a writer called Noor Naga. And her book just came out last week. And her book is called If an Egyptian Cannot Speak English. And this book is like a tiny, slender book. And it's also a story that's told from two perspectives. It's about a young American woman who decides to go to Egypt, the land of her parents' birth, a place where she has never been. And she ends up falling in love with a man who's homeless and who is an addict. And the way that that story moves through these two people is one of the most beautiful and chilling experiences I've had as a reader. And so that's a book that I think will stay with me for a really long time. And I read it very quickly because it's also very propulsive, which are some of my favorite books, you know. But then I'm going to go back and read it. Like, I finished it, and it was the book that I went back to the first page because I was like, oh, I can't wait to, like, have that experience again. So I hope people will check out Noor's book.
That sounds fantastic. And I hope that people also feel the same way about your book. I know each time I've read it, I just want to go back to the first page. And there's so many new themes and different characters to focus on your third or fourth read through. So thank you so much for being in conversation with me today.
Well, I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk with you. I'm so grateful to you for all the ways in which you've helped me to become a better writer. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.